Masters of Text.
Welcome to all the bounty hunters, Jedi, and Sith, but not Gungans, to the Titans of Text. We're your hosts, Eric Ostrich.
And Austerity Nissenfeld.
And we have with us today John and Nick from Legends of Jedi Mud. We're going to talk exclusively about midichlorians and why pink is the best color lit lightsaber. Welcome, John and Nick.
Thanks for having us, man. It's good good to be here. I'm a huge fan of the podcast.
Oh, yeah. When I first found out about you guys last year, and I started listening a little bit every now and then.
Great. Awesome. Let's get started with a bit of history from you guys. How did each of you get into mudding? And what is your general history in the annals of muddom?
Yeah, totally. I started on, Legends of the Jedi probably back in 2002, maybe 2003. I had been involved with some other like online forum games, different Star Wars games. They were all browser based at this point, but some random person, some friend, directed me to this thing called a mud. And I'd really never heard of it before, but I'd been into role-playing enough to give it a try. And, I joined it and quickly got incredibly addicted. And it kind of consumed my life for many years up until the point where, I started taking a more active role in running the game, which was a totally different kind of commitment. But I've been playing now, I guess, 15, almost 20 years. Have definitely seen it through a lot, tried a bunch of different games, but really always came home to, Legends of the Jedi.
Yeah, and I started mudding. One of my friends, I was in middle school at the time, and he was in high school, neighborhood friend. We were all crashing at my place one night, and he's like, hey, let me show you this new game I'm playing. And he logs on his computer and brings up a fantasy-based mud that was my first mud. And that was around 2002, 2003. And that's where I started. And somehow I just really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the RP aspect and the imagination of what you could do. And it wasn't until about 2005 when I was just going through top mud sites, just looking at all the different muds that Legends of the Jedi drew my eye. And so I rolled over there and really got drawn into some conflict real quick because I happened to join at a really hot time in the timeline. And met some people and just really enjoyed it and kept going. And then 2008, I applied to join staff when they were looking for it. And it's been, like John said, a different experience managing a mud from the staff side than just participating from player side.
How did you go from just a player to becoming a staff? You said you applied, were they putting out like mud job postings or was there anything else involved in that?
So I think for most of the newer M's, so you have staff level, which is the actual immortals, and then we have what's called a roleplay council, where players elect other players to manage PKs. So since we're permadeath, you have to have a reason to kill another player. So who govern? And when you die, you can, if you feel like if it wasn't justified or there was some rule breaking involved, you can petition to the roleplay council, and you're kind of like a quasi staff member as a roleplay council member. So a lot of us, we get elected and we serve time in the roleplay council, and then that kind of shows the staff how we handle things, how we, look at things, and get to know us a little bit better. So a lot of the newer staff around that time and still now find their foot in the door through the roleplay council when staff goes out and asks, hey, we're looking for more staff members to actually be more hands-on and operate the mud and manage things.
Yeah, and I think I actually got started that way maybe 2005 or 6. And, what ended up happening was I was on this, council. I was an elected player, and some of the admins realized that I knew how to code. And so purely out of necessity, I started helping them out with the code base, working on things, and kind of grew into the role from there. And, it's, I think like a lot of games, we're volunteer run. And so the, people who are in charge kind of ebb and flow over time, right? You have people who have a lot of free time at one point in their life and then transition out. And, that's really how I ended up, coming into an admin role was the people who had been running the game kind of got busy in their real life and stopped showing up as much. And so I started taking on more and more of it with, different members of the staff. And eventually they just disappeared completely, right? Like there's very few times where there's been like a real transition. It's really out of necessity. And, you know, got to the point where the whole thing's on my credit card now, and so suddenly I'm in charge. But I think a lot of the best, you know, admins we've had fell into the roles because they were passionate about it, and you know, the work needed to get done, and whoever had been doing it previously kind of faded out.
Oh, see, there's the first mistake, letting other people know that you can program.
right.
So there's a player council, which is extremely interesting to me. It reminds me of EVE Online and mm-hmm. the very tumultuous guild councils that they have that the players run. So there is a player council. So what does the staff do? How hands-on are you guys in like the role-playing workings of what goes on in the game?
So that tends to ebb and flow. A lot of times we're very hands-off in terms of the actual game progression. You know, we kind of set up the galaxy and we set up the story and the plot line, and then we kind of give players, you know, we'll fill out clans, we'll put fill out leadership positions in those clans, and then from there we just kind of let the ball roll, and then wherever the ball goes is where it goes. You know, sometimes we have to intervene for rules reasons and for the sake of keeping things interesting, but for the most part we're mostly relatively hands off in terms of directing things.
Yeah, and I think the thing I would add there is that, you know, when people imagine a Star Wars game, they're often thinking about it through the context of like Rebels and Empire, right? This like really classic story that a lot of us grew up with. We try to keep a little bit more of an open mind around where the timeline can go. Oftentimes we're starting far in the past, you know, when the prequel movies were out, or even far before then. And we kind of let people evolve the game on their own. So, you know, a lot of the work that we do as admins is reactive to what's going on in the game, right? So to give you an example, right now in the game, there are a bunch of different like Imperial splinter factions because, you know, the Rebels decidedly lost the war, right? That's not something that happened in the movies. It's something that happened only in our game. But, you know, we've adapted and built out new areas and ships and events and things for people to interact with around the direction the game was already going in. And so it's almost like a sandbox, right? Like people are writing the story as it goes. You know, we reset the game every once in a while to give other people a chance to try a new role or do something different. And, you know, we just kind of let it flow however it wants to based on, you know, people's excitement in a certain area.
You know, that Star Wars being at this point, being a very, very large intellectual property. And you have a lot of timelines. I mean, you have the movies themselves, which is a pretty compact part of the timeline compared mm-hmm. to how much there really is out there that people, and there seem to be people that attach themselves to very specific things like the movies, the 9 movies, the Knights of the Old Republic from the games that came out a while ago. Mm-hmm. The Clone Wars series is another era, the trade war Clone War that happened. Do you get conflict with people wanting, like coming on and wanting to be in those eras? Does that ever cause anything in game?
I think people have a lot of expectations around what they want to do before they've tried it, right? Like the classic thing is everyone wants to be a Jedi or a Sith. You know, it seems like this huge aspirational high impact role because, you know, in the movies and the books by, you know, lesser extent, those are the people that kind of control the narrative of the galaxy. And, you know, I think that it's something that we want people to grow into because in some ways those are the most powerful characters in the game, but in other ways they're almost like sacrificial characters where we have much higher expectations of their behavior and how they move the game along in a way that's, you know, helpful for everyone. And so I think what people expect to be a role that is very like self-serving and fun and exciting and novel, it is, but it's also kind of a burden because you're now responsible for playing these pivotal characters and moving the story along in a way that largely affects other people more than you.
Yeah, and the thing to add to that too is, so like a typical timeline for us, and when we say timeline, we start off a storyline at a certain point, and then a timeline will run somewhere between a year and a half to 2.5 years or so. And then we reset everything. So and each timeline consists of three eras, where generally the first era is like an Old Republic themed era. The second era is your classic Empire versus Rebel era. And then era three tends to be much more sandboxy, as John was saying, based on how era two progressed. You know, it's because for the longest while, there wasn't really a whole lot of material other than it's the New Republic and Uzong Vong and all that, until the new movies came out. So there's always something, like, no matter what your expectation is, there's always a time period in the game where you're going to hit that that maximum excitement. Because I know we have some players who don't like the Empire versus Rebel stuff as much as like the Old Republic or what comes after. So they may not take as much of a lead role in Era 2. You know, they'll still play more of like an engineering or something on the background. But, you know, when Era 1 or Era 3 comes around, then those players will get much more excited at the prospects of what that kind of era theme brings.
We've already kind of heard a bit about it, especially with this like era system, but what else makes Legends of Jedi unique? Like, what are some of the more interesting systems that set it apart?
So I think we want the game to be as sandboxy as possible within guardrails, right? Like, a random guy can't go build the Death Star, but if you want to be a merchant that just builds ships and sells them and goes and hunts pirates, like whatever it is, you have that ability. There is an incredible amount of flexibility that honestly, like, I've never found in another Star Wars game. You know, I think that the combination of a very complex open-ended code base with a lot of nuance that you can learn, combined with a heavy, heavy like role play element, allows people to do things that, you know, maybe when you're playing like a Star Wars video game, which I do, you're kind of envisioning, oh, wouldn't this be cool? Or maybe I could try this aspect, or maybe I could, you know, be influential in this different way. And all of that is possible because of both the code and the roleplay elements we have. And I think that, like, you know, we try to keep things interesting by allowing people to have novel, interesting characters. You know, like, not everyone is running around playing a Mandalorian. I love that show. You know, I love the books when they were out many years ago. But, you know, that's a novel thing if you see one of those people in the game. And, you know, people play it in a really interesting way. And they, you know, influence the direction of the game through those characters in a way that, you know, you can't really do when a game is a little stricter. I know you've talked about in previous episodes, like, what is the difference between a video game or an MMO and a MUD? And, you know, I think for anyone who's a Star Wars fan, this gives them the opportunity to play out that fantasy and see where it goes and have an impact and be someone else in a way that's not really possible in a little, you know, stricter game.
Yeah, and to piggyback off that a little bit, you know, what really fascinated me about LGJ when I first joined on was, you know, I'm more of a mechanics oriented person, you know, so the space system for us is so there's so many nuances to our space system because you have all these different sectors. You could explore uncharted space, and, you know, we could toss Easter eggs out there for people who do explore. Fleet combat has evolved drastically over the last 10 years or so. You know, that's something, like, to me, that's like my personal sandbox in the mud, where I'm always looking at ways to innovate it or to kind of push players into going outside what they normally think is the best way and go like, hey, well, why don't you try this method and see how that works, and just innovating the system, you know, every so often just to kind of push the boundaries on that. Ground PK is the same way, or ground combat rather. You know, there's just a lot of nuances and tactics that it's interesting to see different players evolve into learning or utilizing to enhance things.
So as someone who is, I am aware of, I've like seen all most of the movies. I haven't seen the new one, but like I am aware of most of Star Wars, but I am not like deeply knowledgeable in it. How much of the Star Wars lore do you need to know in order to enjoy the game or be effective, or I guess just have fun?
Less than you would think. You know, in many ways, it is a sandbox of science fiction or fantasy even. you know, knowing what happened in book 12 of the Yuuzhan Vong, you know, like series or whatever, literally won't give you any advantage or disadvantage. It might give you some more role play elements to lean into, but honestly, the people that have the most interesting and unique, like, role play characters are not coming at it from the perspective of emulating something in the stories. They're usually people who are really into creating their own unique characters that have a perspective on what's going on in the game and, you know, want to bring something like different to the world. When people try to like emulate a lot of the archetypes that you see in the movies, it often falls flat because like you're playing a game with a bunch of Star Wars fans who don't want to see the same thing over and over. Now, granted, that's where a lot of new players start if they're passionate about Star Wars and were drawn to the game for that reason. But, you know, oftentimes they quickly evolve beyond that because they realize there is a lot more potential than being like a Han Solo wannabe, right? Like you can be a much more nuanced, interesting character than that. And, you know, I think that makes it friendlier to people who aren't experts on the Star Wars universe as well.
One thing you mentioned, how much people can be and how much you can interact with the world, how large it is. And of course, I'm staring at your website, which is a very nice, clean design, by the way. I'm very, very pleased, especially with the homepage. But on the creating your character page on that page, the first image you run into is the races you can choose. And there, I don't know, there's like a million of them or something. There's a whole lot. And a lot of them require points and require the application. I get, you don't want people running around being a Mandalorian or a Sith just off the bat. I totally get that. But what is the whole points thing? What's going on with that?
So when you first join LGJ, very quickly, you're going to have to be required to create an account. And that's just a way to keep all your characters on the same account. You know, a lot of MUDs do the account thing, but as you play, there's multiple ways to earn points. You know, you could earn points for good roleplay. You could earn points for participating in events or, you know, and every time, well, and every character you play can qualify for points when they inevitably die. So for us, it's a way of, as you mentioned, we have all these different races. Different races have better power, I guess to say, or better level spreads. That's probably a better way to say that. That makes them, you know, more diverse. You know, you could play a combat main, and that's the one thing about LGJ is your combat or your main class doesn't necessarily pigeonhole you into your main class, because we have 11 classes, including Force, that you have levels in all those classes, and based on your race, you may have more or less levels in certain classes. So for like Mandalorians, the way we project them in on the MUD is they're known for their healing capability. So we gave them advanced health regeneration, which is a big, big bonus to have in ground combat. And whenever Mandalorians are in, you know, a lot of people flock to them because they have this huge power boost. So that would be one example of a race that would cost more points. And also it's a way of us kind of forcing some races to be more rare. Like maybe something happened in character where a planet was ravaged, you know, like Corellia was ravaged by the Death Star or something crashing into it. So we want Corellian type humans to be a little bit more rare. So we bump their cost up so less people can play them at the time, given the in character events. And you can also use points to buy levels. That way, you know, you could come out of character creation without having to level your character. You could also use points to purchase Force. So if you wanted to come out being Force sensitive right off the top, you won't be trained. You still have to find a Jedi or a Sith to recognize the Force and take you under their teaching. But that's one way to guarantee you have Force versus our other system where every character that creates has a random chance of having Force.
So earlier you mentioned the flight, I guess, fleet system was one of your favorite mechanics that you've added. Mm-hmm. Can you go into that a bit more?
Yeah, sure. So we've got, I don't know how many classes, but we've broken spaceships down into a bunch of classes like fighters, transports, freighters, gunships, corvettes, frigates, cruisers, and so forth. And so each clan is allowed to have a fleet, which when we say fleet, we tend to refer to ships that are frigates or larger. Those are your main orbit fleet type ship that are you're actually going to war in. Everything less than that is either more individual player oriented or support of the fleet. And we have a unique battle group system where you could link ships, fleet ships together. So you could have one person controlling up to two other fleet ships. And that allows for some creativity where you have one person managing a fleet and you could allow other players in the fleet to manage other things. So you could have one person focusing on firing the ships while the people in those other ships just focus on keeping them alive by recharging the shields. We have a squadron system where each capital ship or fleet ship can store so many fighters on it and remotely control those as well. So it really gives you, when you do fleet battles, you have, you know, frigates, cruisers, and starfighters all swarming over each other. And there's different tactics you can employ to do that. Like starfighter, you know, you have positions to protect other ships. So ships in the outer position of your fleet are blocking fire for any of your other fleet ships that are on the more inner positions. So you kind of slowly have to whittle your way down. Like starfighters and squadrons change that big time because there's different methodologies where you could put them in, you could have like 30 starfighters in the outer screening, or you could put all those 30 starfighters on the inside and have your capital ship screen for the fighters so your fighters can do the damage. And then there's, you could jump to uncharted sectors to prepare for ambushes. We have stuff like gravity wells that you've seen in, I believe, the Rebels cartoon features that pretty heavily, where you could pull ships out of hyperspace into your ambush. There's a cargo system where players can run cargo to earn credits to make their purchases. We've had groups have ships designed specifically to prey on those cargo ships, where they just, you know, kind of like pirate the cargo ship and say, hey, drop your cargo or suffer the consequences. Then they'll grab up the cargo and run off with their prize and sell it off for a nice profit.
The other part of that that I think is kind of unique is most of those ships are created by players themselves. They're designed by the staff. But like, if you, you know, are running a clan and you want to build your fleet up, you have to hire engineer type characters to literally go and build those ships from a template. And so you give people a lot of control over what resources they have access to and like the raw materials, and they can really figure out how to scale that and make it, you know, interesting and big and strategize and, you know, potentially even like sell those to other players. And so you have this whole in-game economy that revolves around it as well, that, you know, can seriously change the balance of events in the game, you know, based on simply like who is more active or who's more creative in finding resources, or, you know, who's good at defending those resources and killing the opposing players. There's a lot of like flexibility there.
Oh yeah. And especially when you start factoring in warfare, because a lot of warfare revolves around the planet game system. So at any given time, we probably have what, at least 10 planets in the game, you know, and we put a lot of effort into making the map just right. So fleet, you know, there's like bottlenecks in the galaxy where at certain points in the timeline, whoever controls like these three planets really has like open season for the rest of the galaxy, because those are like the key battle, you know, a bottleneck aspects of the galaxy where you have easy refueling. It's really quick to get to other planets from there, kind of thing. And that kind of goes into the resources John was talking about, where when we talk about resources, it's not just materials to build stuff, ships, armor, weapons. It's also actual land that you control, territory.
This all sounds like a whole lot of big stuff. How do you handle balancing the game? I mean, other than the whole reset stuff, balancing the game between new players and people that have been around and know the systems and basically know how to min-max their way to whatever they want.
So there's a couple of different ways that happens. One is that because role play is enforced in the game, you know, even though some people are certainly really into min-maxing and the technique of the game, they still need a real in-character reason to do what they do. So you can't just go around killing everyone and killing all the newbies, right? Like, they have some level of protection simply by existing in the game. So that definitely helps. The other part of it, frankly, is that, like, every character dies eventually. Like, there is no character, even, you know, a Sith Lord or a Jedi Master, who is orders of magnitude stronger than any other character. They might be 50% stronger, but they're not going to be 10 times stronger. And so everyone's going to die eventually. And even if that person is really strong on the ground, they might be really weak in space. And so you have this natural balancing built in where, you know, it's pretty unlikely for anyone in a major, like, public leadership role to last more than, you know, one era, which is, like, maybe an era in our, you know, language is the Old Republic or the Empire versus the Rebellion or something like that. So it's unlikely people last past the era if they're really public, because they're the first to be taken out. And then if you're a minor character just doing your thing, like, you know, it is Star Wars. The game revolves around war and combat and all of those aspects. And so it's pretty likely that you will die eventually. What I will say, though, is that, like, we try to make as many of the, like, core aspects of the game public knowledge. Like, certain things are not secrets, even though you can min-max them and need to do a little digging to figure out how. But, like, the actual mechanics of the game are not that unknown. And, you know, I think that there's a balance there between people knowing where to go and how to find the best things versus knowing how it works from a fundamental level that allows them to seek that out. And oftentimes, if they ally themselves with the right groups or the right friends in the game, people will point them in the right direction anyway. So there's not a lot of incentive to, like, really only help yourself and not your teammates. And that does help balance it out. The other thing that we think about quite a bit is, like, probably more of a problem than newbies versus veterans is actually, like, people abusing out-of-character relationships for in-character gain. And it's something that we keep an eye on, and it kind of goes in waves into how severe an impact it has. But ultimately, like, the people who are mostly, you know, manipulating that system are losing out on a lot of the discovery and fun aspects of the game that you get from role-playing. And so, you know, it gets old after a while.
And I think the only thing I can add to that is, so the mentality of LGJ has gone through several phases. Like, I know when I first joined in, a lot of the questions were very play and find out, or help explore was a big one, where it's like, oh, well, if you want to know, explore the game kind of thing. But over the last, I'd say probably 5 years, we've had a big push and change in mentality of everyone should know the basic understanding of how their class and their skills work. You know, maybe they don't know the exact equation of, oh, well, you know, your strength and dexterity is factored in. But engineering is a big example where the engineering class and science classes pretty much go hand to hand, because your science class has all these different science technologies that you have to study up and learn. And depending which technology you've researched might enhance your ability to make blasters, for instance. So for the longest time, it was more of a play and find out to figure out, hey, which sciences actually help blasters. And probably it was probably a year or two ago, we decided to open that up and, like, okay, here's what sciences impact which engineering skills to help newbies specifically. And to sort of, you know, because some people do spread false information in hopes of just trapping people, you know, that was a big reason, was to curb that attitude that a select few players had, just to lower or to shrink that gap between newbies and people who are veterans of the game.
So one of the pages you have on your website, kind of curious, it's called A Guide to Legal Botting. Can you, I guess, go into a bit of what that is?
Oh, yeah. So most online games where you are leveling up a character have some element of grinding. And, you know, for a lot of people, that's the least interesting aspect of the game. And so we've created a system where you are allowed to run scripts and bot certain aspects of the game that are particularly tedious. What this does is a couple of things. So one is it creates a natural time boundary that people are required to go through to get their character to the max level. Like, we don't really want someone to come in and be super powerful day one because it might interfere with like the role play elements of the game. But on the same token, we don't really want someone sitting at their computer staring at a screen, typing the same command over and over for 12 hours, because that's just like not enjoyable. And so we allow people to bot in the background. The interesting thing about botting, though, is that it in some ways is like a risk. It's like, you know, you could get killed while you're botting, right? There's a lot of, you know, things that could go on in the game while you're running a script to study a certain science. And, you know, there is a limit to that as well, right? Like, we don't want someone automating their entire character because that removes the skill from the game. We just want to eliminate some of the grinding that's a little more boring.
We've talked a lot about the shifting landscape of the game itself. Is Legends of the Jedi has been around for a while. Is there anything that you've wanted to change that you can't touch? Is there just something that is regrettable in the mechanics or in any part of the system that you want to get rid of, but you know that you just can't?
Oh, that's a... I'm sure there is. I just can't think of it right now. Like,
I mean, in my mind, nothing is sacred. You know, I have been around the game for long enough to see a lot of these major changes get implemented. And like every major change to every app you've ever used, people are pissed at the beginning. Some people are excited, but it's always a mixed response and people eventually grow to accept it. I wrote a lot of the initial code for the squadron system that, you know, we were talking about earlier, where one person could control a lot of fighters or, you know, an entire fleet. And I remember that like some people were really excited about it when it came out, and some people were super pissed because it, you know, changed the skills that you needed to be successful in space that they had spent a long time learning and practicing. And so, you know, I think that like, honestly, from a code perspective, there is very little that is held sacred. You know, obviously, we're not going to remove the Force from the game. That's a core element of the story. But, you know, the dynamics of how things work have changed really, really significantly over the years. And I think they will continue to change. One of the things that's kept us, you know, viable for more than 20 years, like this game maybe started in 1999 or 2000. You know, one of the things that's kept us viable is that we've always had a active programmer on the team. And you can see like thousands of change logs if you log into the game of every little bug, feature, new, you know, trick that we added going back, you know, 10, 15 years. And it keeps things interesting. And I think that, you know, in the same way that every couple of years we'll just delete the entire player base and tell them to start over, we do the same thing with code sometimes, where we'll roll out a really major change that no one was necessarily expecting, but we had planned for a long time, that really changes the dynamics of things. And sometimes that's, you know, good, sometimes it's bad, and we have to, you know, go back to the drawing board, but it definitely keeps things interesting.
So I'm gonna ask, and I'm gonna call this the infinite wood fountain question. Is there anything that's ever happened in game, like, and in game I mean involving the players, not just, you know, staff talking on a chat channel, that is just too memorable? Like, tell us an interesting story that happened.
I mean, there's a lot of little things. There are characters that are legendary across, you know, decades in our game. Like, you still hear stories about these epic battles and chases and, you know, like things that go on that happened 15 years ago. It's funny though, because I think anyone who plays a game like this, especially if they're young, and a lot of people certainly start mudding when they're teenagers, you know, in some ways you have like rose-colored glasses looking back on what happened. And so there are a lot of these stories, but they're kind of relevant to different people because of different things in their own lives. Like, I have a lot of nostalgia for, you know, when I first started playing, and everything I did was like such a big deal. Like, it really felt like it was really, really freaking important. And, you know, as you gain more perspective, and especially how you see how the sausage is made, in some ways, like, that stuff becomes less legendary to you personally, because you know what actually went down. I think that, like, you know, some of the stories that I remember are when, you know, I had been role playing a certain, you know, way, and because of some unknown information that I, you know, wasn't privy to, an entire plan that I may have been working months on dissolved into thin air because the person I thought was helping me, you know, backstabbed me, right? And you know, they knew that was happening. Other people knew that was happening. I had no idea. And, you know, you see a lot of stuff like that go down where, you know, people are using information asymmetry in an interesting in-character way to make the game more fun and interesting. And, like, that's one of my favorite aspects of it, is that you have this element of play that's not based on technical skill, but is really about your interpersonal skill with other characters, that can, you know, make or break your success in game. I'd like to get more specific than that, but, like, there, in some ways, there's like too many examples to list. But I don't know, Nick. I don't know if you have anything.
Yeah. Well, the first one that comes to mind is real personal, because it was like my first introduction to fleet combat. Because I remember when my first main character was a Balthan spy for the rebellion, and we were trying to do an operation on a planet lord where we were defending it from the Empire. The Empire shows up with this big super star destroyer, and at the time I really had very little experience on fleet, but at the time our commander, who was a staff member at the time, Sharp, goes, "Hey, I need you to man Rogue Squadron." And this is back when the squadron and fleet mechanics or code support was not as well, or not as robust as it is now. So I'm like, sure, okay. And he sends me a link to the website telling you how to man fleets. And he's like, good luck. So I launch with my 12 starfighters to go pretty much screen for our Mon Calamari MC-40 cruiser. And I lose like my entire squadron in no time. And I happen to eject to the planet below, and our MC-40 got away. But it was just one of those, it was just so memorable because of the whole, I look back and laugh at it because, you know, hey, you do this, oh, this sounds awesome. You know, I'm going to man Rogue Squadron. You know, there's books made on this. You know, they were in the movies. This can be great. I've got the link here with the page telling me how to do all this stuff. And it just completely falls apart instantly because I don't know how to do anything. And I'm not, you know, I'm not practiced. I'm not familiar with it. But, you know, the rebellion lived. I lived. We all got away in the end. It was a happiest story because no one died, but we lost the planet. And that's, I'm sure a lot of new players have examples like that, where it's just, even if it didn't go to plan, it's just, you know, it went right in the right way. You know, there's another instance I remember, and all my fondest memories are the Rebel versus Empire, because that, to me personally, that's more interesting to me. Is I remember there was an Imperial Moff who was trying to defect to the rebellion, and the Empire had managed to get tipped off that the Moff was doing this. So we had agreed to a meet with this Moff in some uncharted sector. But the Empire was just that little bit quick trying to catch her. So she's in this freighter flying away from Coruscant as the Imperial fleet is, you know, trying to track her to a halt, trying to speed up to her to block her from hyperdriving. And, you know, watching it real time probably wasn't that exciting, but it's just the mindset of, you know, to me, those are like the greatest moments in LGJ is the chases, you know, are they going to get away? Are they going to get caught? What, you know, it's the nail biting, you know, how's this going to play out? Because depending which way it changes things drastically, you know, either the Moff gets away and the rebellion gets, you know, all this Imperial intelligence and whatnot, or the Imperials get her. And then maybe she flips on the rebellion based on what she knows. So it's that divergent story that a lot of these stories play out as, where it's just, it's exciting waiting to see what happens and how it plays out. I'm trying to think of moments for other players, because I really don't want to talk about all our stories.
I know. I feel like I have too many stories that I would like to, you know, that in some ways I'm like embarrassed about, because it was a different time and I was kind of a newbie or had different priorities. But I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of Legends of the Jedi. No pun intended.
So we're gonna close out with the question we always ask. What is on the horizon? But it's a space game, so there really is no horizon. What is in the future for the Legends of Jedi Mud?
Specifically,
I'm referring to you on this, man.
Right. So I guess lately the biggest push has been trying to, for the Immortal staff to have a little bit more engagement in the planet game, or not planet game, in the game events. And that's not to say that we're looking to side rail what players are doing. It's more of to give players more opportunity to flex their role play lines and to give them an opportunity to pursue what they want to do. So like traditionally we tend to have a very laissez-faire approach on things, where we kind of, like I said, set the ball rolling and let players handle it. But sometimes you need an outside catalyst to really spark things, because sometimes players do get in the concept of kind of like a Cold War situation, where all sides are just kind of happy where they are. They may want to do something, but they don't know the best way to go about it. So you could throw an event in there, and it doesn't even have to be an event that forces in the fight. It could be something as simple as, like, you know, there's this quest to help out this Bothan spy, or this hut take over a small sector of Nal Hutta kind of thing. And he's giving out this big reward. And a lot of times, just even something as small as that is enough to get players going, to get storylines mixing, more engagement activity between the players of different groups, you know, because a lot of times they stick with their clan or friends of their clan, and they don't often all the time interact with opposites. You know, it's just like, you're on your side, I'm on my side, we're good. So I think that's one big thing that we're trying to work towards more, is creating those catalyst events where, you know, it doesn't have to be anything big, it'd be something small, but it just allows players an opportunity, because a lot of players get super excited when it's an immortal driven event, because it's, you know, it's like, oh, this has official admin backing. You know, this is actually going to mean something. You know, the rewards are going to be nice. You know, it's something worth participating and getting excited about, which may not necessarily always be the case when you have a more player initiated, player started event within the confines of player limitations.
And on that note, I'd like to thank you both for coming on the podcast and talking to us about the Legends of Jedi Mud, and hopefully this inspires some people to give it a try.
Yeah, hopefully it's a wild place that has kept me addicted for 20 years. So there's something there.
Yeah, 15 years ish here now. So you know, like I said, if anyone logs on, we have an OOC channel, MChat. Feel free to hit us up however you want. We have, our player base is actually really good about helping new people. That's also a big thing that our roleplay council likes to get involved in, as well as helping new people adjust and learn the game. And it's been a big thing in our community to be very helpful to newbies.